You're listening to KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon, streaming at korcfm.com.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
This is Civics Cafe, heard on KORC's News, Music, and Civics, Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m., repeating Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m., also heard Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m., following the many moods of Ben Vaughn, here on KORC. This is Wendy Byrne, bringing you the Corvallis Civics Cafe. This week, I had the pleasure of sitting at the Dizzy Hen Cafe in Philomath to gather thoughts and plan the show. I enjoyed my coffee, omelet, and buttered biscuit with jam, pleasant music playing in the background, mingled with the sounds of conversation and cooking. It is a warm and welcoming place to enjoy a meal, so get on out to Philomath and treat yourself when you can. Thanks for tuning in to the Corvallis Civics Cafe. Let me serve you up the news from the City Council this past week. City Council meets on the first and third Mondays of the month, but this month, the third Monday, was Martin Luther King Jr. Day, so Council met on Tuesday, the 21st. They were scheduled for 4 hours of meetings, sitting at the dais on the second floor of the downtown fire station through three meetings in a row. The work started at 4 p.m. with an executive session to, quote, consult with Council concerning the legal rights and duties of a public body with regard to current litigation or litigation likely to be filed, unquote. Executive sessions occur behind closed doors, without public attendance, and minutes are taken, but not published, so we can only guess as to which litigation they discussed. But given their very recent conclusion of the case of Councillor Ellis versus City of Corvallis, I am pretty sure I know what they discussed. More on that at the end of the show today. Some things should be saved for dessert. The executive session went 20 minutes over the scheduled time, delaying the start of their work session about parliamentary procedure. During the work session, the city recorder provided guidance and training about meeting procedures to both new and returning council members. I was never involved with student government during my school days, so I find overviews of this quite helpful to my understanding of the hows and whys of meeting procedures. Following guidelines helps the meetings run smoothly and ensures city staff are able to provide the council with information in time for their meetings. Last but not least, at 6 p.m., the regular meeting began with an update from the City Parks Department about their plans for improvements at our Martin Luther King Jr. Park in Northwest Corvallis. After the presentation from Parks and Rec, community comments were allowed. 4 of the 8 people who spoke strongly urged the mayor and council to take no action to appeal the court decision regarding the Ellis case, and to offer to pay the legal costs, as well as find a means to both apologize for the fiasco and explain the steps that led to the attempt to oust the councilor. The rest of the meeting proceeded without incident through the published agenda. At the end of each meeting, there is time for the mayor, city council, and city manager to share their own comments. It's a shame that their comments come so late in the meeting that most of the audience has left the room or signed off of the Zoom call, because that is when the councilors are allowed to address the concerns that have been raised during the community comments. For example, on Tuesday night, late in the meeting, the mayor informed us that the city would not be appealing the decision in the Ellis case. Thankfully, for those interested, each meeting is recorded, and the recording is available via vimeo.com/cityofcorvallis. On Thursday at their work session, City Council heard a presentation from the members of the Corvallis Climate Action Advisory Board on recommended actions the city could take to help the community as a whole make progress in meeting the goals of our Climate Action Plan. More specifically, the Climate Action Advisory Board members presented 8 actions geared to reduce carbon emissions from buildings in the community and asked Council for guidance as to which of the 8 the city would consider pursuing. The feedback was robust, with support noted for many of the 8 actions, most notably the 2 actions that address retrofitting existing buildings, both commercial and residential, to improve their efficiency and resilience in the face of our changing climate. Tellingly, at least to me, is the fact that the younger members of the council were supportive of taking on more, if not all, of the 8 actions. There was support for a renewed look at the city adopting a mandatory home energy score, with useful words from Councillor Jan Napak about positive ways our local realtors might be encouraged not to fight against the writing on the wall for the usefulness of such a score. Residents of Ward 9 might want to check in with their councillor, Tony Cadena, regarding his comments, which implied that he feels the city should not pursue efforts that may have been negated by large fires such as that have happened in California. When the video for the meeting becomes available, you can hear for yourself how he recommended that the city has more important things to spend time and money on than meeting the goals of our climate action plan. Despite many councillors supporting several of the actions, the city manager threw a wet blanket over the enthusiasm by noting that due to staffing constraints, it would be best to address no more than two issues at a time. The Climate Action Advisory Board agreed to return to the council at a later date with more information about the two aforementioned actions. When I'm lucky enough to have breakfast at a cafe that serves biscuits, I try to save half of one to eat with jam at the end of the meal. It's kind of like having dessert after breakfast. So, for the jam and biscuit portion of this show, I have this article from the January 25th print edition of the Gazette Times, written by Ella Hutcherson. Corvallis will not appeal a federal judge's ruling that clauses in the city's charter are unconstitutional, and efforts to expel Councillor Charlyn Ellis based on those clauses are void. Mayor Charles Mann announced that council has no intention to file an appeal during mayor's reports at the Tuesday, January 21st City Council meeting. This decision aligns with encouragement from community members to forego an appeal. These same individuals also urged the city to pay Ellis's attorney fees. Mann told Mid Valley Media that the city will be compiling information delineating the whole ordeal into a single webpage in hopes of educating the public. "We want to make sure everybody understands that it was not an attack and it was not malintent," Mann said. "It's just that there are certain processes that get triggered by certain things." A proposed resolution from December 2023 accused Ellis of violating the city charter 3 months prior when she raised a concern that a city hall vacancy was stalling the work of an advisory board she chaired, and again when she made a motion that would have asked the city manager to fill that vacancy. The resolution said, because of these actions, Ellis had forfeited her seat. The city argued that by directing the city manager to carry out a duty that is at his sole discretion, she was violating a section of the city's charter, which is kind of a constitution for cities. The verbiage in question, known as Section 23F, prohibits councillors from influencing or coercing the manager in the making of any appointments or removal of any officer or employee. Ellis did not forfeit her seat willingly, requesting a due process hearing, which was rescheduled several times. Ultimately, the embattled Ward 5 councillor filed a lawsuit alleging that the city was violating her free speech rights. On January 10th, U.S. District Court Judge Ann Aiken released her findings that two clauses in Section 23F are unconstitutional on their face under the Oregon and U.S. constitutions. She also found that Corvallis unconstitutionally retaliated against Ellis for exercising her First Amendment rights at the Climate Action Advisory Board meeting where she initially raised the issue of the vacancy. Mann said he was honestly surprised by the judge's decision, as many cities have similar language in their charters. "It's very interesting how a single word can change a perception or definition," he said. "The city is going to release a summary of the judge's decision in layman's terms," he said, "and will be assembling information about how this situation came to pass so that the public can access it in a single place online." A charter review was on the docket regardless of the lawsuit's outcome, he said, and 23F is certainly a component of that review. He said council will work with its attorneys to ensure the language is cleaned up, but ultimately all changes to the charter must be approved by voters. Regarding the decision not to appeal, Mann said council leaned that way because the judge's decision was very clear. "Based on that language and thinking what would we gain from an appeal," he said, "council's view is there is nothing to be gained." A single motion of Ellis's was denied by the judge, but the councillor also will not be seeking an appeal, she told Mid Valley Media. During the Tuesday council meeting, many members of the public took advantage of the time set aside for community comments to speak about the matter. All of them sided with Ellis and with the federal judge's decision. According to Ellis's primary attorney, Jesse Buss, prevailing plaintiffs in civil rights cases are often paid by the non-prevailing government entity. Corvallis City Manager Mark Shepard said that the city's legal counsel is still in discussion with Ellis's attorneys on this issue. As of October 2024, Corvallis has already spent upwards of $260,000 in legal fees. Moving forward, Mon hopes that people don't blame City Council for what happened because the council as an entire body never had an opportunity to evaluate the situation. I would say if there was any failing here, it was a process problem, he said. There are absolutely lessons to be learned, he said, and now that the case is settled, he foresees council working to provide more effective governance and to accomplish the work that the city needs done. A charter review is part of that. We need to get with modern times, Mon said. We're doing that with our facilities. We're doing that with our fees and processes and our fire departments. We need to do that with our language, too. This article was edited for brevity. The full article can be found on the website of the Corvallis Gazette-Times at gazettetimes.com. I'm hoping to bring more information on this situation to the Corvallis Civics Cafe next week. Thanks for listening to the Corvallis Civics Cafe, heard on KORC's News, Music, and Civics, Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m., repeating Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. Also heard Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. following the many moods of Ben Vaughn here on KORC.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll. In light of this last week's events, as we usher in a new era of American democracy, or lack thereof, we recall that presidential companion and the world's richest individual, Elon Musk, gave a clear Nazi salute on national television during the inauguration of the country's 47th president, Donald Trump. Some mainstream and right-wing so-called news services have spun the narrative, saying it was due to Musk having autism. These same outlets have called Musk a, quote, genius, unquote, in the past. Some have called it a Roman salute. Others denied it outright or didn't mention it. This harkens to memory a quote from the George Orwell book, 1984. The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. As we move into times when history may repeat itself, or even science fiction novels like 1984, or movies along the lines of Mike Judge's Idiocracy, seem more like prophecies than fiction, we must grip the reins of our critical thinking, band together when the need arises, and teach our children the difference between right and wrong. That is a challenge in today's world. There is a poem written by a German pastor, Martin Niemöller, is known as First They Came. The following information comes from the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust website. They're online at hmd.org.uk. Pastor Martin Niemöller is best known for writing First They Came, one of the most famous poems about the Holocaust. But he is a complicated figure. Initially, he was an anti-Semitic Nazi supporter. His views changed when he was imprisoned in a concentration camp for speaking out against Nazi control of churches. He later encouraged Germans to take responsibility for Nazi atrocities. Martin Niemöller was born in Lippstadt, in the west of Germany, on January 14th of 1892. He was the son of a priest, and in 1910 he joined the German Navy. During World War I, he was assigned to a U-boat, which is a German submarine, and eventually became its commander. Niemöller followed in his father's footsteps and started training to be a priest in 1920. The 1920s were a difficult time for many in Germany, and Niemöller took a part-time job laying railway tracks to earn money while studying. Many people, including Niemöller, believed that the new German government, the Weimar Republic, was unable to deal with the continuing economic and political problems that Germany faced. Support for radical political groups like the Nazis grew. Life worsened for most Germans when the Great Depression, which was a worldwide economic crisis, started in 1929. Businesses were closing, and many people lost their jobs. During the 1920s and early 1930s, the Nazi Party under Adolf Hitler became increasingly popular. They blamed the country's difficulties on Jews, foreigners, and the weakness of the Weimar government, and promised they would improve ordinary people's lives. Niemöller was one of the Nazi Party's early supporters. After being ordained as a priest in 1929, he remained a strong supporter of Hitler despite the party's hatred of and discrimination against Jewish people and other groups. Like many Germans at the time, Niemöller believed that the Nazis and Hitler would provide strong leadership to make Germany a powerful and respected nation again. He also saw the Nazi Party as a way for Germany to return to the Christian morals he thought had been abandoned, even referring to Hitler as an instrument sent by God. Niemöller's eventual split with the Nazi Party came when they started to control the German Protestant Church. They appointed an official leader of the church and changed the text of the Bible to remove what the Nazis saw as, quote, Jewish ideology, unquote. After meeting with Adolf Hitler in January 1934, Niemöller started to see the Nazi state as a dictatorship. Even then, although Niemöller criticized the German government for interference in religious matters, he did not criticize the discriminatory laws forbidding Jewish people from marrying non-Jews and preventing Jews from having jobs in government. Niemöller himself held anti-Semitic views. In the 1920s and 1930s, he referred to Jews as a, quote, despised people, unquote, as well as Christ killers. The only arguments he made were that Jews should be allowed to remain members of the church once they converted to Christianity, and that the German government should not interfere with the way churches were run. Niemöller's opposition to the Nazi regime's rules for churches saw him arrested several times, as he became increasingly critical of the Nazis and Hitler. In July of 1937, he was arrested again, held for 8 months without trial, and rearrested immediately after his release by the Gestapo. That was Germany's secret police. He was then sent to Sachsenhausen concentration camp. At this point, these camps held political prisoners, in addition to those perceived as threats to society, such as Jewish people, gay men, Roma and Sinti people, and asocials, which included alcoholics and beggars. In 1941, Niemöller was transferred to Dachau concentration camp, where he would spend most of the rest of the war. Finally, in 1945, he was transferred to another camp in Austria, where he was liberated by American troops in April of 1945. After World War II, Niemöller repeatedly expressed regret at his previous support for the Nazi Party and his failure to oppose it more broadly. In 1945, he admitted that he never quarreled with Hitler over political matters, but purely on religious grounds. However, it is notable that the first public record of Niemöller apologizing for his own anti-Semitic words and views was not until 1963 in a radio interview. In October of 1945, just a few months after the war ended, Niemöller headed a group of German churches who admitted they did not do enough to oppose the Nazi regime. Niemöller was one of very few Germans who called on their fellow citizens to accept their responsibility for Nazi atrocities as well, saying in a sermon in 1946, quote, we must openly declare that we are not innocent of the Nazi murders, of the murder of German communists, Poles, Jews, and the people in German-occupied countries. And this guilt lies heavily upon the German people and the German name, even upon Christendom. For in our world and in our name have these things been done." Unquote. The poem for which Pastor Niemöller has become most well known is First They Came. This poem was also written in this post-war period. Niemöller gave many lectures on a world tour in 1947, which included his poem, leading to several slightly different versions. He was one of the few to speak out quickly and say that the German people should accept responsibility for the murders of 6 million Jewish people during the Holocaust. This opinion was often not well received in Germany at the time. Niemöller remained a controversial figure for the rest of his life. The revelation that he wrote to the German Navy in 1938 and 1941, volunteering for military service during his imprisonment, ultimately damaged his reputation. Nevertheless, his lengthy imprisonment at Sachsenhausen and Dachau made Niemöller a symbol of Christian opposition to the Nazi regime. After the war, he traveled the world, becoming a popular figure due to his speeches sharing the German experience of life under the Nazis. He died on March 6th of 1984 at the age of 92. This was in Wiesbaden near Frankfurt, where he passed away. Niemöller's poem has inspired people across the world to speak up for others when they face discrimination. But of course, his personal history is complex. His story is a reminder that people often do not fall neatly into a category of good or bad, and we must learn from experiences like his to understand how the Holocaust happened. I'm going to read his poem now, First They Came. First they came for the communists, and I did not speak out, because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out, because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out, because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out, because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Kroll.
This is Wendy Byrne with a list of the City of Corvallis meetings for the week of January 27th to January 31st. The Economic Development Coalition will meet at 4 p.m. on Monday, January 27th. The meeting will be held virtually and in person at the City of Corvallis Council Chambers, located on the second floor of the downtown fire station. The downtown fire station is located at 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The Climate Action Advisory Board will meet at 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday, January 28th. The meeting will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, located at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue in downtown Corvallis. The agenda and electronic packet of information for the meeting can be found online at corvallisoregon.gov. The Planning Commission will meet at 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, January 29th. The meeting will be conducted online only. The agenda and electronic packet of information for this meeting can be found online at corvallisoregon.gov. On Saturday, February 1st, Ward 9 Councilor Tony Cadena will host Government Comment Corner at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Please stop by to say hello and ask your questions about local government. The Corvallis-Benton County Public Library is located at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. This has been Wendy Byrne for KORC's News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. A new, large, multi-use development is coming to downtown Corvallis. After sitting empty for years, the site that used to house Flat Tail Brewing is again going to be occupied. Along with the adjacent Blackledge Furniture Warehouse, the site will soon be home to a hotel, apartments, and a handful of restaurants and shops. The project is being built by OB Companies, a property development company out of Eugene who specializes in projects that center around community spaces. They're known for the Gordon Hotel and Gordon Lofts development and the 5th Street Public Market, all in Eugene. Here's from the Gazette Times. The Corvallis project, similarly named the Gordon Hotel and Gordon Residences, will include a 75-room hotel as well as 92 homes in the same building. It is an $85 million investment in the city. The project will also feature a tavern, rooftop taco and margarita spot, and secret bar, as well as a community kitchen, game area, fire pits, a grilling station, a fitness studio, a pet wash station, bike storage, and resident parking. According to OB, exact prices for the hotel rooms and residences are not yet known, but they will follow market pricing. OB Company's CEO, Brian OB, said the team is developing in Corvallis because they identified a, quote, desperate need for housing and a, quote, great need for full-service hotel. Housing and rent prices have been rising in Corvallis for years, and it is consistently ranked the most rent-burdened city in the state. According to Community Development Director Paul Bellotta, 7,900 people commute into Corvallis for work, and about 2,400 of them are commuting due to the housing shortage. Only 11,100 both live and work in Corvallis. OB said the combination of permanent residences and transient lodging has been an attractive component of the Eugene development for those who live in and visit the Gordon Hotel and Gordon Lofts. OB Companies also has a plan to develop a mixed-use project in downtown Albany, though no further details are available at this time. OB expects the project to have a positive impact on downtown Corvallis. He foresees a significant increase in activity and shopping and lauds the many opportunities for people to, quote, graze and participate in the community that already exists in the downtown area. City Manager Mark Shepard also expects the development to activate downtown spaces and provide a boost to downtown businesses and restaurants. Shepard said when the city first heard that OB Companies was targeting First and Madison, it tied into the city's efforts to invest in the historic Madison Avenue corridor. Currently, Corvallis is evaluating the concept of a new civic campus to house city services, which has received some pushback from the community. This evaluation is part of a larger overhaul of the city's aging facilities and ties into a decades-long vision of a Madison Avenue corridor that provides a physical connection between the riverfront, the downtown district, and Oregon State University. OB said the city has been encouraging and helpful as they've gotten the residential project off the ground. He expects about 50 employees, maybe more, to work at the Gordon Hotel and Gordon Residences. It is unknown as of now how the project will impact the downtown area as far as driving and noise are concerned. Dozens of folks, for example, live in the neighboring Corvallis Hotel apartments above Treebeard's. On the Obi Company's website, a computer-drafted model of the proposed site shows a large multi-story building which may impact the view of the eastern skyline for residents of the Corvallis Hotel, let alone the construction noise. As for the concern with driving around downtown, one can foresee potential issues, especially with traffic already affected by the nearby Van Buren Bridge construction. Groundbreaking is set for February, and it will be available for use in 2027. Much of this report was read from the Gazette Times article entitled Unique Hotel and Residential Combo to Hit Corvallis Riverfront, written by Ella Hutcherson. Special thanks to the Gazette Times. This is Nick Martin with KORC.
Hi, KORC listeners. This is JC, and I have the privilege of hanging out with Ren Hike and his dad, John Hike. And I'm going to be interviewing Ren because he is a local musician whom I'm impressed with. So, John and Ren, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Hey, thank you for having us.
So, Ren, could you tell us a little bit about where you were born and raised?
I've spent my entire life in Corvallis. I was born there, and then I recently moved up to Olympia because I'm going to college up here. But yeah.
So what are you studying in college, and where are you going to school at?
Right now, I'm doing a psychology and music course up at it's called Evergreen University up in Washington.
So you are studying some music.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Do you want to tell our listeners what instruments you play?
I play guitar and I sing, and then that's all I do for the project.
Did I hear you say project?
I did say project.
Could you tell us more about what that project might be?
I recorded like a 5-song EP with my friend Charlie. I just went to high school with him, and we basically recorded the whole album in my back room, and it was a great experience. Yeah.
So where'd you get the songs?
I wrote them all.
You wrote, very cool. So you wrote the music, You performed the music, you recorded the music and released it as an EP.
Yes.
Can you tell our listeners how old you are, Ren?
I am 19.
Very cool. Which school? Yes. Which high school did you go to?
I went to CHS, Corvallis High School.
So, Ren, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about your guitar skills, how you learned to play guitar, and what kind of guitar you play?
Yeah, I've been playing guitar since I was like probably 8. My dad actually taught me for like the first, 5 years, right?
Yeah, less, but yeah. You started teaching me there after a little bit, so.
and then I took lessons from this local dude named Nick.
Nick Rivard,
yes.
Nick Rivard, you said?
Okay. Yeah, he gives lessons out of fingerboard extension. Yeah.
Hey, shout out to Fingerboard. So you got some lessons from Nick at Fingerboard, right? Or who's from Fingerboard. And what happened from there?
I've been taking lessons from him since I was like 7th grader, I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. So my, I don't know, he's really helped me like become a better musician. So just like over all that time, that's kind of...
So what made you decide to start writing music or writing lyrics and creating music?
I would just say a way to express myself and just like get my emotions and like ideas out in a way that was productive, I guess.
So I'm assuming that you have some emotions that you were dealing with. In order to express those, you decided to write some music, right? Or write some songs, I should say.
Yeah, just like that.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what some of your songs are about? What's some of the subject matter?
A lot of it is about just like being somewhere that does not work for me very well. I don't know, like just like kind of being somewhere that I can't express myself. It's also about relationships and women sometimes. Yeah.
I don't know any songs that have ever been written about relationships before, right?
Like,
right?
I can't think of one.
You know, like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and on and on and on, right?
Yeah, dude.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about what genre you think your music is?
That's a hard question.
Yeah, it is. I've listened to your music, Yeah. And I was having a hard time classifying it too.
Yeah. I took a lot from like 90s bands, like a lot of grunge. That was what got me. And then of course all the classics like the Stones, the Who, Zeppelin. And then it kind of like all mixed together. And I don't know what I call my genre, but it's like that. I don't know. Like alternative rock. That's like, yeah, I don't know.
That's a really good point. Yes. So I'd agree with that. It does sound like an alternative. So it is. I agree. I hear some Zeppelin in there. I hear some Stones. So what drew you to that type of music, Ren?
Well, my dad helped a lot. He's been playing that kind of music, at least like the 70s, more classic rock, since I was like zero. So that's, I just have kind of always been around that music, and I was just attracted to that kind of stuff. And then when I got older, I got more into like 90s stuff, like I said.
So John, you also play music, I'm assuming, play an instrument. Do you also write some songs as well?
No, I'm still working on my first song.
It's so good. It's so good.
So I play for fun, you know, but I used to own Bombs Away, so we, you know, did live music 4 nights a week for 8 years. When I grew up, it was important, and then Ren always, the soundtrack of Ren's growing up has a lot of Who in it. a lot of Who, a lot of Pete Townsend, and just like, and 90s stuff, so... I'm taking lessons from Nick Rivard right now. So it's, and a lot of it is to kind of be not a collaborator, but maybe a co-pilot of some form for Ren as he's going through stuff that, you know, the vernacular and like just stuff that's going on that, you know, that I'm kind of involved in the music process from the music side of it. I feel I'm pretty good from the, I definitely a music file as far as history of bands and how, and history of bands going down the tubes and things that work and success stories, you know, like you do on your show all the time, right? If like what works, what doesn't, you know, everyone says, why are you doing that? You know, what are you going to, well, if every musician listened to the people around them, we would have no music, yeah. Right? So, and then you look at, there's around the world, 7 nights a week, there's bands playing 365. So it's actually, there are musicians that are out there doing it, whether, you know, degrees of success, but they're doing it. So that's kind of my role, is to coach, harass, encourage, you know, and, you know, give space and all that stuff.
Those were the words of John Hike, father, harasser, co-pilot, as he describes himself, for his son, local artist Ren Hike. We're going to take a short break so we can hear one of Ren's songs. It's the song Brother that he chose for this segment, and it was part of his 515 five-song EP.
Drive that easily. All strung out, my thoughts are all in knots, and I don't have the mental clarity. Going on this ever trampling, up and down, yeah, mountain round. Your mother's love can only take you so far. As I stare at the damage you've impaired, ripped away the man I used to know, and I don't have the mental say so. We'll be right back. the bag of distant memories. I hope that is not what remains. And I don't have the mental clarity. Blowing booze, it's compromised your youth. Cut away the man I used to know. All strung out, no thought or word of mouth. I don't have the mental clarity. We're just going on this ever trampoline. And there he goes, walking out the door, never to see him or hear from him again.
Was local young artist Ren Hike with his song Brother from his 515 project, which includes five songs on an EP. Let's continue our conversation with Ren and his father John.
So we just heard a track of yours, Ren, called Brother, right? Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about how that song came about? And
where do I begin, man? I would say that it's just about a friend I have who has been through an interesting time. I was having some feelings about it, and I said earlier that I express how I feel through my music, and it was just a way to get those feelings out, I think. So it was just about how everything kind of was happening in my life at that time. That was kind of what Brother was about.
So you start with the lyrics, I'm sure.
Poetry,
a little bit, or a riff.
I kind of do like I start with a chord progression or like a musical thing, and then I try to add a melody over that. And then the lyrics come later, usually for me at least.
Oh, okay. Yeah, everybody has their own technique, right? Absolutely. Yes. So, in the song that we just heard for Brother, was that your solo effort, or did you have somebody accompany you?
Yes, so on all the recordings, my friend Charlie Quintana, he played drums and bass on all the songs, and he, like, recorded every song, basically. So he was a huge, like, part of this thing. So, yeah, he played drums and bass on a lot of it, and I played guitar and sang.
Okay, so Charlie Quintana, is he a Corvallis resident as well?
Yes, I think he's up in Seattle now, but, yeah, he lived in Corvallis.
Okay, cool. And you guys went to school together, I'm assuming?
Yeah, same age, yeah.
This is so cool. So much talent here in Corvallis. It's very cool. So do you guys have a band name, or do you just go by Ren?
The project that I've that has been this project is 515. It's just like the time. I thought that was cool.
Okay. Can you tell us about the relevance of 515?
Yeah, it's a Who song from Quadrophenia. That, yes, it's a good song.
So tell us a little bit more about the relevance of 515 and Quadrophenia, and why you named this project 515.
Me, my dad, and Charlie had a circle, and we were like, what do we call it? And we, like, and I finally was like, all right, The Who is awesome. And I just looked on the album, and then, like, I heard that song, and I was like, that would look so cool if I was just, like, on top of my album.
Excellent.
And then that's how it is.
Tell listeners, if you could, about how you're distributing this beyond KORC and your local community radio station.
It's up on all streaming platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, and then I think we have some CDs down at Happy Trails.
And we are going to send a copy of the EP to all college radio stations in Oregon and Washington to try to get some airplay and just bootstrap it, pretty much.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. So for listeners' information, if you want to check out Ren's project 515, it's at Happy Trails Record Store, or you can stream it online just about any platform.
Yep.
Okay, great. And then KORC is also going to add Ren's project to the library, so you'll hear that. So what are your future plans? What are your ideas for the future musically?
Hey, I'm trying to get in a band right now. That's my most immediate goal that I want to get. Mostly just trying to, like, perform the music I write to people, yeah, in my band. I just want to tour, pretty much.
Oh, yeah, I told him I would, I'll drive the van. Yeah, really, like, trying to find a band right now is the,
yeah, man.
Kind of the urgent and important item, you know, so Ren has some folks to collaborate with and to be able to go out and to play this, at least the EP, and then he has a bunch more material that he's working on. So there's we're kind of at a, you know, it's not hard to probably find a band, but it's
hard, man.
It's harder than we thought.
I want to thank you guys so much for bringing your music to the Corvallis area and allowing us to share that.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure talking with you.
You just heard an interview that I had with John and Ren Hike. Ren is a Corvallis native who just released a 5-song EP called 515. It's available at all streaming services as well as Happy Trails Records. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following is an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Tuesday, January 21st, 2025. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is KORC.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier is coming home after nearly half a century behind bars. Just minutes before leaving office, former President Biden granted Peltier clemency, ordering his release from prison to serve the remainder of his life sentence in home confinement. In a statement shared by the NDN Collective, Leonard Peltier responded by saying, quote, "It's finally over. I'm going home. I want to show the world I'm a good person with a good heart. I want to help the people just like my grandmother taught me," Leonard said. Biden's historic decision came after mounting calls by tribal leaders and supporters in a community-led campaign that fought for Peltier's freedom for decades. Biden's order goes into effect February 18th. Biden, however, reiterated his action was not a pardon for Peltier. Leonard Peltier is 80 years old, has spent the majority of his life in prison. For decades, he's maintained his innocence over the 1975 killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in and South Dakota. Many have said his conviction was riddled with irregularities and prosecutorial misconduct, and that the federal government failed to prove its case against Leonard Peltier. Democratic Presidents Bill Clinton, Barack Obama rejected Peltier's clemency requests. He was also denied parole in 93, 2009, and 2024. For more, we go to Sumterville, Florida, where we're joined by Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of the NDN Collective. He just visited Leonard Peltier in prison after news of his release yesterday. Nick, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you share with us Leonard Peltier's response? It was minutes before Biden left office.
Leonard is elated. Leonard is excited. He's deeply, deeply honored. When he, like, I talked to him on the phone last night after the actual order was given to him, and the papers for executive clemency were given to him, and he read it out loud, and he said, I'm finally coming home. And he's excited to be coming home in this moment. And one of the biggest things of the message that he has is deep gratitude for the five decades of organizing and everybody who's ever helped fight for his freedom. And so he is elated. He's excited to go back to his homelands in Belcourt, North Dakota, on the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa.
And Nick, could you talk about the movement to get Leonard Peltier released? There was a large group of congressmen led by Raul Grijalva who appealed to the president. But at the same time, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, on January 10th, wrote to the president urging him not to do it.
Yeah, this was an unprecedented effort of both community organizing and advocacy. You know, we had two secretaries of the administration weigh in. Secretary Deb Haaland was weighing in, and Secretary HHS Administrator Becerra was weighing in. Senator Schatz, of the Senate, chairman of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, was weighing in. And there was opposition. There was opposition led by the FBI and the Department of Justice to try to keep Leonard Peltier in prison. But the reality is that we had fought so hard to be able to bring this issue to light. And I think that one of the tipping points in this entire issue was the fact that Leonard Peltier was a boarding school survivor, and that this was really about righting a historical wrong. And I think all of the work that went into bringing to light what the United States government did to Indian people during the boarding schools, and all of that effort and organizing and healing work that happened, was one of the huge contributing factors, along with so much political advocacy of people championing this. And we were able to close the gap from the front line in Indigenous communities to the decision makers, right to the president of the United States, that led to this. And so it was a historical organizing effort and a day of victory for Indigenous people.
Absolutely amazing, Nick. We talked to you right after you talked to the pardon office. You were in South Dakota then, after you went to Washington, D.C. Finally, on the issue of Leonard Peltier going home, how is his health?
He needs to see a doctor right away. We were a little bit concerned that he's not going home until the 18th, that the order doesn't go into effect till the 18th. He needs to see a doctor immediately, and they don't have the medical facilities at Coleman Prison, federal prison, to meet his medical needs right now. So we will be asking this current, the incoming administration for relief for medical purposes to try to get him home a little bit sooner. And they do have the ability to do that at the Bureau of Prisons level. And so we're going to be asking for that so we can get this, him to see a doctor. But realistically, we also understand that there's a good chance that he's probably not coming home till the 18th, even though we're trying to get him home sooner. But we really want to get him home sooner because his health is continuing to deteriorate, and he's excited to come home, but we got to make his health and his safety number one priority.
Nick Tilson, you've also worked on climate issues for years. On Monday, Trump signed an executive order to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement again.
The next item here is the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty. We're going to save over $1 trillion by withdrawing from that treaty.
So you hear him signing this in the Capital One arena with 20,000 people cheering. The significance of this, Nick.
It's terrible. It's terrible for everybody around the world, because not only the Paris climate agreements, but the agreements to for the most powerful countries in the world to come together to fight climate change and set bars for it, to force corporations and force countries to be able to, have regulations in place, and to pull these back is to put our environment at risk, and to put human rights at risk, and to put and these decisions are going to expedite climate change. And at a time when climate change is a global crisis issue affecting all of humanity, and with indigenous people, it means a direct threat to us and our homelands, because we are maintaining, we're 5% of the world's population, but steward 80% of the world's biological diversity on behalf of all of humanity. And so that means when him pulling out of the Paris Accords, it means that he's going to make indigenous communities and indigenous homelands sacrifice zones. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be on the front lines having to fight these corporations, because now they're going to end up into our territories completely deregulated.
Nick, there's so much to talk to you about, but I want to quickly, it's a fire hose of executive orders. President Trump also signed an executive order Monday calling for North America's tallest peak, Denali, in Alaska, to be renamed Mount McKinley after President McKinley. He said, showing respect to Ohio and to the president. Can you talk about the significance of what Obama renamed in 2015?
Well, renaming these, we have been in this effort to rename our territories after what we call them as indigenous people. And this effort to try to erase indigenous people and erase our identities, that's what this is. It is manifest destiny in its modern form. It is colonial rule that is trying to control the narrative, and it's trying to erase indigenous people. And so we're going to continue to fight to hold on to our names. We're going to continue to fight to hold on to our identity. And we're going to use this energy that we have in Indian country right now, that we have gotten from this victory in fighting for Leonard Peltier, to protect our homelands and to protect the names, and to make sure that they won't erase us. And you can guarantee the indigenous people that we're going to be on the front lines fighting this administration and making a way for our people and fighting for human rights everywhere.
Well, Nick, we want to thank you for being with us. Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of the NDN Collective. You can go to Democracy Now! To see all our coverage of Leonard Peltier, including interviews with him. Again, at the age of 80, Leonard Peltier is going home after almost half a century in prison.
That was an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Tuesday, January 21st, 2025. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
The public is invited to a special program Tuesday, January 28th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m., The event is titled Oregon's New Land Use Rules, How and Why Your Neighborhood May Be Changing. The forum will be held at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. There will be simultaneous web access via Zoom. The event sponsor and primary organizer is the League of Women Voters of Corvallis, with co-sponsorship by the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition's Land Use Action Team, the Corvallis Benton County Public Library, and the City of Corvallis. Speakers will include Peggy Lynch, the League of Women Voters of Oregon Natural Resources Coordinator, Ethan Stuckmayer, the Housing Division Head at the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development, and Paul Bilotta, Community Development Director at the City of Corvallis. The presentations will focus on the changes to the state land use laws, the motivation behind them, the impact on local jurisdictions, and the implications for public engagement. That's Tuesday, January 28th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library on Monroe Avenue. Oregon's New Land Use Rules: How and Why Your Neighborhood May Be Changing. There's more information at lwvcorvallis.org.